This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Dr. Paul Yanover. Paul is a urologist, a leading specialist in his area. He's going to talk a little bit today about coronavirus, how that's moved things to telehealth, what that looks like, and more. Dr. Yanover, can you take a moment and introduce yourself?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me on the show. I certainly appreciate the opportunity. So I'm a urologist, a urologic surgeon, and for some of your audience members who may not be completely familiar with my subspecialty, it's a surgical subspecialty dealing with kidneys, bladders, prostates, urinary issues, kidney stones, prostate cancer, and then, of course, cancers of all those different organs. And my practice is in general urology. I'm in private practice. I'm in the heart of Chicago at Lincoln Park. But I practice with a very large single specialty urology group called UroPartners, which is the largest urology practice in the Midwest. We're about 60 urologists plus lots of mid-level extenders, et cetera. And we've been in practice. I've been in personal practice for 16 years in Chicago. I also serve as the chief analytics officer for UroPartners, which is, they didn't know what else to call me. I'm a bit of the data nerd for our group, which means I wear, I practice every day in clinical practice, but I also serve as we have an internal team that looks at a lot of our data, and we manage a lot of our data. As you imagine, 60 urologists. We have a lot of patients with a lot of issues that we have to handle, and we've actually been very aggressive about sort of managing the data that generates. And that's one of my jobs is to lead that team.
Well, fantastic. And Dr. Yanover, tell us a little bit about urology practice. A lot of it's elective, a lot of it's not elective. Talk about in the context of COVID-19, and what do you see now? What do you see the ramp up being? And then we'll talk about what you're doing on the telehealth side with respect to urology.
Sure. Well, like with most things in medicine, as I'm sure you guys are more than adequately aware of, essentially things have sort of distilled down into sort of three big buckets of where people practice, whether it be urology or other specialties. Is essentially we have, private practice, which is where, that's where my sort of focus is. There's hospital-based medicine, where you're essentially an employed model. And of course, there's the academic model. And obviously, there's some blending and some overlap. But I think, in the context of, of any medical discussion, whether it be, health policy or economics, or which, the COVID involves pretty much every aspect of healthcare, from A to Z, each one, if you're practicing in one of those different silos, the world is going to look a little different. We're one of the great equalizers, of course, is, we're all under this, mandate now, but before, even just weeks ago, there was a lot of it was up to each provider as to what's considered, quote unquote, an elective surgery. Mine is a surgical subspecialty. We also have, though, a heavy sort of office-based practice. Some physicians are more surgical-based, some physicians are more medicine-based. So it's not very homogenous. But that's one of the big things, right, is we've got patients coming into our offices. We also have elective surgeries, and then we have to grapple with the idea of what is elective, what's not elective. It's something we still to this day don't have, I don't think, a sort of perfect handle on. We've got lots of guidance, American College of Surgeons, the American Urologic Association. But really, one of the things I've noticed being on staff at multiple hospitals is that every hospital group, I was actually kind of shocked how disparate sort of the initial reactions were, of how each hospital system, here in Chicago, there's North Shore, there's, of course, all the academic centers. We have Advocate, we have Amita, and each one was sort of free to sort of make their own policies and give their directives. That's all sort of merged in and have sort of lined up, I would say, across the board. But I was kind of surprised how each one was taking a little bit of a different course.
Let me ask you a question on that.
Sure.
Were you surprised at how quickly, after they originally started on different paths, because everybody's trying to figure this out as it goes,
right,
how quickly sort of the standard of practice and what people are doing started to align together? Were you surprised by that?
No, actually, I was surprised how long. I mean, I guess this is my just sort of my personal view, but I was surprised how everybody seemed to approach it very differently. I was surprised how long it took for everyone to get aligned. I think part of the issue, I think it comes from a lot of different things. One is, your personal view. I mean, we're talking now in mid to late February, early March, which seems like a lifetime ago. I think everybody brought to the table a different view of what the virus was going to be doing. I think everyone thought differently as to what April, May, and June was going to look like. And I think that was coloring everybody's sort of attitude. I think, as I mentioned before, I think if you were in private practice, if you were employed, or if you're in academic practice, I think your view in the world is already a little bit different. Your incentives are different, how you're compensated, sort of the acuity of the care you're providing, and also the sophistication of the hospitals that you're at. I think one of the things that keeps coming up in the lay press, but it's a real deal, which is, how much protective equipment have we been provided? If you're at an institution where you've been provided with excellent protection, you feel more secure. And if that is a something that hasn't been readily available, or if you don't have great confidence in your hospital's ability to protect you or to really screen the patients or really make it a safe environment to practice, I mean, this is the first time.
Let me ask you a question on that.
Yeah,
I want to
sure.
ask you two follow-up questions to that.
Sure.
We're now, this is being recorded April 20th or so.
Right.
What's the PPE situation today versus a few weeks ago? And again, completely apolitical.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it getting better at this point? Is it getting worse at this point? What is it starting to get ramped up? What's the situation with that?
It's bit of a mixed bag. And I think part of that is, yeah, beyond all the political aspects, I think, everybody was caught with their proverbial pants down, if I may mix metaphors. But I'm a urologist, so I can do that. I think all the medical systems, all the governments were all caught off guard from that perspective. And I think the other thing that I saw changing, sort of akin to what I was referring to earlier, was basically everyone's attitude or vision or sort of urgency. What was this really going to be like? Was this really going to be a horrible pandemic, or was this going to be a little bit more like a flu-like outbreak? And I think how careful we were being has changed pretty rapidly. And that's, I think that's part of the change that we're witnessing. I think the other thing was all the data. This was so novel, so new. We had very little data. We still don't have very much data about the disease. And so, our attitudes of how much PPE you need are very different today than it was even 4 weeks ago. I mean, I'm in surgery. One of the big questions we didn't know was, what was that plume of virus that occurs with intubation and extubation? What bodily fluids are you going to find? I mean, it's obviously in saliva and mucus, but is it in stool? Is it in urine? We're doing laparoscopy. Is it going to be in the plumes of the insufflation, the gas we use to insufflate the abdomen? And these are things that, I mean, I remember just weeks ago, these things are popping up literally like whack-a-mole, where, you think you sort of solve one issue and then 10 others prop up because it's novel. We're making up the playbook as we go along. We don't have great data, and the data that is coming in, it keeps shifting.
It's all over the place.
The data is all over the place.
And this leads to having to be very risk averse and make sure you have more than enough PPE, very careful on procedures, because even though the ultimate fatality of this rate, who knows where it will land up, because we really don't know how many people have actually been infected
right
until there's a huge amount of testing. But we do know that for a certain percentage of people, it's very, very lethal. And so it's quite scary. And we also know that a lot of healthcare providers are on the front lines and being infected. So this need for PPE is so critical, and all these other procedures. They're not all PPE procedures, but at what point will you view it? Is PPE, you see different pieces of this where it seems like it's right. getting a little bit better, but not abundant. Is it getting any better, or what's the sense of it?
Well, I think a lot of that is the setting which you're practicing. You know, I am thankfully, I do have to go into the hospital. I do have to operate, for non-elective work. I do see patients in my office, though pretty sparingly. So, you know, what I'm experiencing, very different than the anesthesiologist, the emergency room doctors, and quite frankly, the nurses who are on the front line. And, you know, it's very spotty. Again, it's a little shocking, but not too surprising that you're going to have these pockets where you've got some systems that have deep pockets, were prepared, have large caches of appropriate PPE, and then there are other places that were, you know, caught off guard and are still scrambling, still reusing things, etc. And I think, you know, there are little microcosms, there are micro environments, right? So what's downtown Chicago looking like versus the suburbs, which I don't practice, so I can't even speak to what's up in the suburbs, very different than what's happening in downstate Illinois versus what was going on in New York. You know, I trained.
But to practice health standpoint, not yeah. physical health, but financial health in yeah. analytics, you know, so many practices and so many health systems make so much of their revenues, which pays the bills and keeps them moving, through what are considered quote unquote elective procedures, you know, or they're truly, we view them as elective or not. If you need an operation for a prostate cancer, it might be able to put off a little bit.
Right.
So it's elective for the moment, but not for very long. But to really ramp up elective surgery, which is so critical to being able to economically make it work, you can't have mission without margin, they've always said, you know, and the adage. How important is it that you get this PPE issue solved? It seems like the ventilator issue is much closer to getting solved, far better than it was in Italy or some of these other countries. Like, we're not denying patients ventilators, at least now. But PPE seems like a real problem and a holdup in getting things really ramped up again. For the elective stuff.
I would say yes and no, but it is so multifactorial. I mean, getting to the economics of it, I mean, that's one of the things that I do bring a pretty, I think, an accurate reflection of what really the landscape is like, because on, you know, as I always say, I have to worry about the health of my employees and my healthcare workers. I have to worry about the health of the health and well-being of my patients, but also the health and well-being of my practice, which is a business. And right, all the ambulatory care centers, all the hospital systems, all these private practices, we're all operating under sort of, a similar business model, right, which, as you point out, all involve lots of elective work. And then, right, for that to have been upended literally within weeks in a completely disorienting way, which we have no, you know, we have no contingency plans for, it's doing economically what the virus is doing medically to people. It's creating, you know, havoc in its wake. I mean, pretty unfathomable havoc. The economic ramifications, I don't think we've even begin to start really understanding and seeing, because I think those waves are going to be compounded. They're going to be coming. We're going to be seeing economic ramifications of this virus in medical economics in ways that are, you know, that we haven't even gamed out. But to your point as to how do we get back to that sort of near normal of the model that we've always operated on is going to be it just like opening up the general economy. The same, I think, tenets are also going to hold. We need to know right now every single patient is treated as a potential, as a likely positive. It's sort of, you're positive until proven otherwise. And I think that is the safest way to operate, but that's not going to be sustainable long term, right? So I think access to adequate PPE is vital. It's the cornerstone. But I think it's not nearly going to be enough before we can start resuming sort of those routine procedures You know, in urology, there's lots of, most of the stuff we do is routine, sort of elective, can certainly be put off, if not indefinitely, certainly for short term. You know, lots of other specialties, you know, orthopedics, you know, lots of other specialties operate on the same sort of, you know, this paradigm.
Economics, for
the same economics.
For sure.
But we're going to be dependent on, just like everyone keeps talking about, having rapid point of care, reliable, accurate testing for our healthcare workers and for our patients. You know, we are going to need to know, is this patient COVID positive or not? And we're going to need to know, is this patient a certified immune? You know, we need to know, has the patient.
And let me ask you a question on the testing issue, because, you hear Abbott says as of June, they'll be able to ramp up 20 million antibody tests a month. There's all this discussion of some of the antibody tests that we're getting from overseas aren't really accurate or close to accurate. I mean, the reality is, whether you blame the president or federal government or not, whatever you blame on this, one thing that's clear is we're not getting clear talk on it. We're not getting clear talk on the reality is this is going to take a while to ramp up. The ventilators seem to have gotten ramped up to closer to the point of need, maybe not totally, but closer. But PPE and testing are things that we need in the tens to hundreds of millions. And that's going to take a while to ramp up. So what does that do to the ramp up? Does that mean you have to be just so overprotective? And as you just said, assume that everybody is positive in how you treat them, which means a lot of extra care, a lot of lack of efficiency and stuff like that. Is that sort of the recipe we're on for the next 6 to 12 months as this stuff really ramps up to the amount that you, I mean, and I don't understate the problem in a country of 330 million. I don't really cast blame nor understate the problem. If I cast blame, it's for not straight talk about it. But how do you sort of manage that when we know testing PPE is going to be, it's going to take time to ramp up to the right levels?
No. Everything you said is spot on. I would say, that's absolutely correct. I think one of the most frustrating, certainly there's plenty of blame to go around. There's plenty of people to be frustrated with. The situation itself is pretty frustrating. I think the PPE and ventilator story is sorting itself. I mean, and I say this not with great authority, right? But just from the foxhole in which I'm fighting, the PPE and ventilator story appears to be settling out. Thankfully, because we don't have a Italy, New York, Spain sort of situation, particularly here in the Midwest, where, you know, I'm looking because we get daily briefs on the numbers, and certainly I'm not an ID doctor or an epidemiologist, or have my master's in public health, but you don't need to really have even gone to medical school to see the trends, see the curves, the data that I get from our local, from my two healthcare sort of systems that I'm in, and you can sort of see, thankfully, we've skirted the edge of outstripping our ventilator support. I think our understanding of the disease has also helped change who needs a ventilator. I mean, that's the other issue, is our approach to the disease is changing pretty rapidly, again, because we're getting a lot more data. That's helped keep people off ventilators, and I think that's helped one of the many pieces of this. But we're seeing sort of, right, at least here in Illinois, somewhat plateauing of the curve. And the whole notion of flattening the curve isn't just to prevent the spread of disease. It's really just keeping the number of patients spread out long enough that it stays under our resource limits. And I think
let me ask you a question about that.
Sure.
Let me ask you a question about that. Because I think a lot of our great fear as lay people is that, okay, so we flatten the curve through this, you know, tremendous lockdown. Will that curve just peak right back up as we get out of lockdown? Is there a different strategy at some point that has to be used? Because if we're just locking it down to keep it low, does that mean when we unlock down, it goes right back up and we get back to that problem?
Well, that's where I'm personally, I am most frustrated with, because, you know, a lot of the stuff with the PPE and the ventilators and the poor rollout of preparedness for all of this, you can't unring a bell, you can't undo that. But looking forward, as we start to see the plateauing, so now you start gaming out, well, maybe when can we start taking off the brakes? And you know that this is going to be region by region and locality by locality. But what's frustrating to me, getting back to the testing issues, I am very frustrated both with the way the government is articulating, and I think there's a really, really poor job of educating the public about testing, because that's going to be what we talk about. You know, before we talked about ventilators, we talked about the surge, we talked about PPE. The next conversation that everyone's going to be familiar with in the next six weeks to 6 months is going to be testing. Because testing is going to be how we get out of this until there's a vaccine or a reliable therapeutic, which isn't, you know, going to be in our immediate short-term future. The only way we're going to get out of this, where we don't keep this complete blanket lockdown, is starting to get real, true, accurate, that's the key word, understanding, and real time. So we get fast results that are very accurate as to who has the disease and who is immune to the disease. That is the only way, from my understanding, and really just common sense will tell you that, instead of having this blanket lockdown, you're going to start, you know, giving some relief. But the only way, you know, so you can do sort of micro lockdowns. And now micro lockdown is when you've identified someone who's COVID positive, and do quarantining, selective, you know, very smart quarantining. And that's the only way you're going to get out of it. The only way you can do that is with rapid point of care, accurate testing that we don't have now. That's probably one of my biggest sources of frustration is the testing story, what you're reading about from the CDC, the WHO, the FDA, and the fiasco of, you know, I just read an article about, you know, the CDC's approach to trying to create their own tests versus what the WHO had, and that's to see who's positive as opposed to the antibody test, which has two pieces, right? Because, you know, when you get exposed to a virus, there's a short-term phase, and then there's a long-term, you know, immunity phase, and those are different antibodies, those are different tests. And we need all of that. You know, this whole thing, this notion of certified immune has to be researched, it has to be understood, and has to be articulated to both healthcare workers and to the lay public, because people need to understand this. They're never going to buy in to what we all need to do unless they understand it. And I think the literacy in the lay public is very low, and I think that's a government responsibility as far as I'm concerned.
Right. No, and the literacy of the lay public, it's a great thing you mentioned, because we certainly have gotten all up to speed on so many concepts we thought we would never hear, whether it's social distancing, ventilator supply, herd immunity, PPE. You know, I'm in the healthcare world, and I thought PPE until we had these discussions was property, plant, and equipment.
Right.
And I've spent 30 years in living my life entirely in the healthcare world. And so we've all coming more up to speed and stuff. And testing, I think people are getting clear on. What they're not getting clear on is the different supply chain pieces that go into it and the focus that's needed to really ramp up testing, how we have to ramp it up. I mean, and you know, it is just challenging, and we obviously need great focus on getting it better and better. Let me ask you just a couple more questions, Dr. Yanover. Talk for a moment about the use of telehealth in your practice and what you see there and what's going on with that and how that has evolved during this period of time.
Well, that to me, you know, I guess I'm an eternal optimist, although I never really consider myself such. And I think telemedicine is one of those silver linings of this whole fiasco. I mean, we're learning a lot about our medical system and some of the shortcomings. And I think telemedicine is the advent of telemedicine, which was sort of forced into sort of prime time with the virus, has been one of those things where we've made some, you know, lemonade out of lemons. You know, I've been interested in telemedicine. I practice in the city, in the heart of the city. Patients have pretty easy access to my office, but this old model of, you know, I've got a clinic, patients have to come to me in order to be seen, you know, the old sitting in a waiting room, checking in, making appointments, getting seen, getting checked out, you know, et cetera, which we're all familiar with, is pretty antiquated. And while it's certainly necessary, in-person visits, the ability to lay hands on patients, even just to visualize a patient, do tests in real time at point of care, and to do care coordination is vital. That will never go away. At least I hope it never goes away, because that is where good medicine is practiced. But for a lot of patients, particularly well visits, as well as discussions about next levels of care and coordinating care and all these other things, that can be done very well on telemedicine. And to me, you know, earlier on you mentioned one thing, which is as a private business owner as well as a surgeon, efficiency is to me the goal of most things, and inefficiency is a four-letter word. And telemedicine, when done well, can provide a lot of efficiencies to a practice. And the fact that CMS has, you know, quickly changed the rules, we have secure platforms that are very reliable these days. I mean, I can't even imagine trying to do this 10 or 15 years ago. It would have been near impossible. So we've opened our doors to telemedicine. For urology, it's been wonderful. I had a clinic today where I had, you know, 14 patients I was able to see through my telemedicine portal. These are patients who, number one, none of them needed to be seen in my office. We could take care of pretty much everything through the portal. I'm able to see the patient, interact with the patient, have a nice chat with the patient. I'm able to order tests and order medications. Now, obviously, there's certain tests and procedures that I can't do, obviously, through telemedicine, but I can coordinate that, and they can come in at a later date when it's a little more convenient to get some of that their lab work and other tests done. That's been phenomenal. I think patients love it. It's very convenient. It's kept them out of the office, so it's kept them out of the waiting room. You know, I think in the post-virus landscape, I'm hoping that telemedicine stays, you know, in some form or another. You know, we can't predict what CMS will do, because that's going to dictate everything. But, you know, I would love to see telemedicine gain a much stronger foothold and be part of our practice. Obviously, there's plenty of limitations.
Let me ask you another question on this. It's you're a person who's very smart, who's also got great personal skills. How important is the bedside manner? Is it going to be the same whether you're in person or on phone or virtual? I mean, when I talk about bedside manner, obviously it's an old term from way right back, but the concept being of how do you deal with your patients and how do you deal with them personally? Because that's so important to ultimate care. It's not just being great analytically, but actually good at making people feel comfortable so they'll talk with you and so they can work through their problems and issues and hopefully be able to provide the kind of care with the kind of insight you need as a physician. Any special tips to how you work with people by telehealth versus in-person? And is that a skill set that people have to learn and adapt to?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the shorter answer is yes. You know, I think in-person, you know, we as humans, we feed off of non-verbal cues, right? We're constantly getting bombarded with body language and situational sort of cues that will enhance or be a detriment to a visit. And I think, you know, as humans, we've been practicing those for, you know, unconsciously for, you know, since we're little kids. The new medium, it changes a lot of that, and some of that is lost in the translation. Even on a face-to-face screen time, you still don't have this. It's not the same, and it can't replace the warmth, the sort of human connection, which is really important to medicine. You know, it's the touchy-feely side of medicine that is that can't be overspoken. It is very important. And, you know, the interface, one of the limitations of telemedicine, it's easy to be distracted. You know, our patients are distracted when I'm talking to them. It's easy for me to be distracted as opposed to, you know, when you're one-on-one in a patient's room, in exam room, it's easy to sort of, you're cocooned and you're in together and it's just the two of you. And it's a lot more intimate. Whereas when it's screen to screen, you don't know what else is going on off screen. You know, that's one of the downsides. And I think that's why it is an inherent limitation. And that's why I don't think it will replace, but I think it will only, augment what we normally do.
But even without the perfection to it, it is still something where, and it will get better and better, and physicians will get better at it, and you have to say to your patient, I need you to focus and stay attentive here. But there's so much efficiency in it. It's just like the urgent care became so popular because people want care when they can get it, where they can get it.
Absolutely.
And this is the next level of that, where people just love the convenience of not having to spend 2 hours going back and forth, parking, making a whole day of it. They make their appointment 15 minutes. You're able to see patients a lot quicker. So there are a lot of efficiencies to it.
Oh, absolutely. No, it's a value. To the point you're making, right, is it is a much more – if it can be done in an efficient manner, but also that is just as good from a healthcare perspective as an in-person visit, it by your definition, it is a more valuable experience, right? Because the patient is taking less time out, parking, the hassle, the inefficiency of taking time out of your day to go to the doctor's office, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that has a lot of value, and that's why that I do not want to abandon telemedicine as part of our practice. And I would even ask you to play a little more 3D chess. So in the post-virus world, right, a lot more of our patients are going to a lot of our patients are going to lose their insurance, which is going to be a whole different ball game that's going to change the landscape, making a cheaper, more efficient visit. If you don't have insurance, this may be the best thing you can get until you are insured. But think about the number of practitioners that we have available is going to go down, at least in the short term. There are practitioners who are going to retire. There are practitioners who got sick, both nurse practitioners as well as all of the doctors, specialists and non-specialists alike. And so and our healthcare systems are going to be undergoing huge fundamental changes. So given that rocky landscape, this is the lifeline. The telemedicine is the lifeline for patients that I don't see, and I certainly hope, does not go away, at least in the immediate future, for all the reasons why you mentioned.
No, 100%. Well, Dr. Yana, we appreciate your time so much today. Just brilliant. We'd like to have you on again, of course. Thank you so much for joining us. We have more time. I could talk to you for another couple hours. But unfortunately, we don't, and our audience might not abide by it. But I thank
right.
you so much for joining us today. Just fantastic. Thank you.
Well, it was a pleasure. I enjoyed the conversation, and obviously we're fans of the broadcast. I just hope that everybody out there stays safe and stays sane. It's not easy to do either, and certainly look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you very much, Doctor. We appreciate your time today greatly.